Those are some of the voices we brought you earlier this year in a program about domestic workers in New York State organizing for a Domestic Workers Bill of Rights. Well, those years of campaigning finally paid off in late August when a package of protections was passed into law. It's a historic event for basic workplace protections to be given to more than 200,000 nannies, cooks, and other domestic workers. And joining me now to talk about how that campaign was won and what it means is Ai-Jen Poo, the director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance. She's speaking with me by Skype from New York. Thanks for joining us, Ai-Jen.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, let's talk about the Domestic Workers Bill of Rights. What does it include and how many people are affected?
The Domestic Workers Bill of Rights includes a basic set of protections, including overtime pay for live-out workers after 40 hours of work per week, for live-in workers after 44 hours. And the overtime pay is counted at time and a half of your regular rate of pay. In addition, it includes protection from discrimination and harassment, which was a huge issue. A lot of domestic workers are fired when their employers find out that they're pregnant, and a lot of violations around discrimination and harassment, and there had never been protections before. There is inclusion of both part-time and full-time domestic workers in disability protections. There's a minimum of 1 day of rest per week, which is particularly important for live-in domestic workers who work around the clock, and a minimum of 3 days paid leave per year. So obviously, most employers should be providing at least 2 weeks paid vacation and paid leave per year. But some employers don't even follow that, and some employers don't provide any paid leave. So this mandates that there has to be a minimum of at least 3 days paid leave per year. And what it means is that the over 200,000 women who do this work, taking care of homes and families across the state of New York, for the first time will be included in the labor law and be recognized as a workforce like any other, where lots of families and communities are dependent on this profession for a living and to support entire communities.
And the law just went into effect in early December, as I understand. Have you seen any changes in the industry so far? Any indication if it's working?
Oh, well, I do know that employers around the state are actively, paying attention, and many of them for the first time are realizing that they are employers in their own home and they have obligations as employers to provide a living wage and paid leave. And so it's creating a shift in consciousness for sure for the employers in this workforce, and also providing more of a basis upon which many workers can negotiate for benefits and for raises. And now that they have the formal recognition in the law, they can actually approach their employers and negotiate, starting from a real floor. And we've gotten lots of calls from employers trying to find out how to do the right thing. So I think that it's the message that it's sending is getting through. And for those who want to do the right thing, there are now real good resources and more awareness among them about what to do. And for those who are trying to get around following the law, there's now actually some basic guidelines that we can hold people accountable to.
Were there any additional points or stronger protections that you were hoping got covered in the law but were left out after the long and arduous journey through the New York State Legislature?
Absolutely. This is just the beginning of what is necessary and lays a good foundation, but we definitely have to build on it. And the Senate bill, the bill that had passed through the Senate, was actually very strong and much more reflective of where we need to be working towards. It included 5 paid sick days per year, a week notice of termination or severance pay. It included a week's paid vacation. So there's real allowances for the fact that this is a job like any other. There should be basic benefits, basic paid leave. And so I think we've got a long way to go to work towards those pieces, but we've got a good foundation to build upon, and workers every day are negotiating for those things already. So in practice, also the greater awareness that it exists is also facilitating the prospects for us gaining these things in the future.
So what can you say about the organizing effort? Why were you able to succeed in this case? I mean, this is an instance in which most of the affected parties are low-income people, people of color, many of them immigrants. These are not the folks who usually are able to have their voices heard by government officials. Why did it work?
It's a great question. I think that what was really powerful about this organizing effort was that the stories of domestic workers were really at the center of it. And so many domestic workers gave up so much of their time, day's pay, really made a lot of sacrifices so that they could tell their stories and that the broader public and the legislature could have a better understanding of the texture of the day-to-day life of a domestic worker and just how vulnerable people are in this workforce. And tied to that, we were also able to draw upon the stories of everybody that domestic workers are connected to, their own families and children, their employers and their children, who their employers who count on them every day in order to be able to go to work. And I think that being able to bring everybody's stories to bear and say that it is in everybody's interest that this workforce is recognized and that we respect this work and protect it was a powerful story when you heard it from so many different directions. And we were able to create the kind of campaign that, of course, was led by the domestic workers and their experience, but also so many other people, whether it be children who are raised by domestic workers or union members, doormen, for example, who see domestic workers in the buildings that they work in every day and know very well what they go through when they have a bad employer. All of these different people were able to play a role in this campaign, and I think that that's part of what made it so powerful. We really saw this as a movement that we created around this vision for respect and dignity for domestic workers. And it's a movement that it continues to build even after we've won the bill and will continue to build, not just in New York, but around the country. One of the actions that we did is a good example of this. We organized a Children and Families March for the Bill of Rights in 2009. And it brought together the children of domestic workers and the children that they care for. And they led the march and they carried signs that said, respect my mommy and respect my nanny. And it really showed the interconnectedness of all of us as families in this economy and how much we're all affected by these issues, even when it may not be so readily apparent. And I think that that was a powerful message and sort of one example of how we approached the work and the issues in this campaign.
Yeah, you mentioned this making waves across the country. I wanted to ask about the National Domestic Workers Alliance. We've been talking about New York, where you're located and where you've been organizing for quite a while, but that national organization, which formed in 2007 at the first U.S. Social Forum, is where you officially work. Did that national alliance, how did it play, if it did that national alliance play into the local campaign in New York?
Absolutely. The National Alliance was founded in 2007, as you said, and we have 33 affiliate organizations in 17 cities and 11 states around the country now. And in the final years of the Bill of Rights campaign, domestic workers from all over the country came to march with us. They came to also tell their stories. They came to support New York domestic workers. And many of them learned from the work that the New York organizations did. And now in California, our California affiliates, there's 9 domestic worker groups in California who are working together to introduce and pass the first California Domestic Workers Bill of Rights. So it's a really exciting way that having a national alliance has allowed us both to win locally, but also share lessons nationally and learn from each other.
And by the same token, I'm wondering how the National Domestic Workers Alliance is affecting similar campaigns in other parts of the country. I know workers in California in particular are trying to get their own Bill of Rights. Where is this headed in the national picture?
In the national picture, we are establishing labor standards and passing bills. We're going to be working on getting bills of rights passed in states around the country. California will be the first after New York, where they'll be introducing legislation in January of 2011. And after that, we've just gotten word that our affiliates in Massachusetts are going to be leading a campaign to pass the Domestic Workers Bill of Rights in Massachusetts in the coming years. And in addition to that, there are lots of localities and municipalities that are interested in doing city-level ordinances and resolutions in support of rights and dignity for domestic workers. Another exciting development is that the International Labor Organization, which is the arm of the United Nations that makes labor laws internationally, will be passing a convention or international law on domestic work. And the first round of negotiations on that took place in Geneva last June. And this June, in June of 2011, they'll be completing their negotiations on this convention. So come August, we'll have our very first set of international labor standards for domestic workers. So not only is there a national movement, but there's an international movement that's raising up the conditions and the work of domestic workers so that it can be recognized and protected. Finally, I'd say that we as a national alliance are very excited to be launching a national effort called Caring Across Generations to bring together domestic workers with home care workers and other workers in long-term care, together with elders and with people with disabilities, to propose, to develop and move a vision for transformation in long-term care in this country that both recognizes the importance of honoring our elder generation and ensuring that our aging population in this country has access to quality care and has a dignified quality of life, while in the same breath, it also recognizes the importance and the dignity of the work that is elder care work. And so we're going to be proposing legislation this year at the national level that creates jobs in long-term care and home care, sets labor standards for both domestic work and home care work, and creates new pathways for career advancement, job training, certification, and legalization for the workforce that is going to be doing this work. And finally, that creates tax credit and support for families who are paying out of pocket for care. So it's a comprehensive vision to transform long-term care in this country in a way that really meets everybody's needs and addresses everybody's concerns in the picture.
And this past year, Social Forum, domestic workers were branching out in the same token to what you're saying with elder care workers and took part in an excluded workers assembly. That seems even more inclusive. It included types of people who don't have basic workplace protections, like farm workers, taxi cab drivers, and there were even teaching assistants from universities. What can you talk about the importance of that cross-sector organizing, and can we expect to see more of that in the future?
Absolutely. The Excluded Worker Congress is a project that we're really, really excited about. It brings together 9 sectors of workers who, either by design or default, have been excluded from the labor laws in this country, including farm workers, domestic workers, workers in right-to-work states in the South, restaurant workers, workfare workers, guest workers. So many, many different sectors of workers who are excluded in different ways under a banner of human rights, and really trying to bring forward, trying to show on the one hand that even though we've fallen outside of labor laws and particularly the right to organize, that workers have been organizing and have been very successful in some instances in making real change, especially where people said it could not be done. And so there's these beautiful models of workers coming together and organizing outside of the traditional collective bargaining context, where they've made major headway and have created major building blocks for us to think about organizing and the right to organize for the 21st century. And why that's so important is that more and more workers are falling outside of the protection of labor laws. Between the fact that more and more workers are losing their jobs and there's more and more unemployed workers every day, that more and more workers who traditionally have been protected by collective bargaining laws are not actually able to exercise their rights to form a union. And so we actually need a new framework for collective bargaining in this country and to really protect our basic right to organize, to form unions, to assert our rights on the job. And in these excluded worker sectors that have been forced to really be creative and work outside of that framework, there's a lot of important lessons for workers in this country.
I just wanted to go back for one second. The international treaty you talked about, will the U.S. be a signatory to that?
The United States has actually played a very helpful role in the development of the convention. The Department of Labor, under the leadership of Secretary Solis, has really supported a strong convention on domestic work. Now, the U.S. has historically not signed on to many conventions at the ILO, so we're not sure whether it will be ratified by the United States, and that's a decision for Congress to make. But in terms of the development of the convention itself, the U.S. government has played a very positive role and a very supportive role of domestic workers' rights.
We've been speaking with Ai-Jen Poo, the director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance. We'll link to their website on our site, radioproject.org. Ai-Jen, thanks so much for joining us, and congratulations on pushing through the Domestic Workers Bill of Rights in New York State, the first in the nation.
Thank you very much for having me, and we will certainly need the support of all of your listeners and all of their friends in order to continue building this movement and continue to create protections and recognition for this workforce.